You might not realize it, but some of the absolute deadliest diseases out there, things like certain aggressive cancers or HIV, or even parasitic worms,
Right.
they actually use this specific biological cheat code to hide from your immune system. Like they drape themselves in this specialized glycoprotein disguise that basically tells your white blood cells to just stand down.
Yeah, it's a brilliant survival mechanism, but they didn't invent that disguise.
Exactly. They hijacked it.
Yeah.
They stole it from a microscopic machine that is built by the human body itself.
A machine whose entire sole purpose is to survive a really hostile environment, deliver this densely encrypted genetic payload, and execute an incredibly precise chemical breach.
Yeah, we are, of course, talking about the male reproductive cell.
And it completely shatters the simplistic view we usually have of this biology, right? I mean, in introductory classes, we're shown this really basic diagram. It's just a flat little circle with a squiggly tail.
Like a tiny biological tadpole.
Exactly. But the reality is that the male gamete is this highly specialized, just remarkably complex deployment system engineered for survival.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because our mission today in this deep dive is to shortcut your way to understanding the sheer mechanical genius of this cell.
We really want to get past the high school biology version.
Right, so we pulled a stack of sources, starting with excerpts from the Wikipedia page on sperm. And we're just throwing out that two-dimensional textbook drawing entirely. We want to look at the microscopic chemical warfare, the evolutionary extremes, and honestly, the bizarre legal frameworks humans have built around this stuff.
It's fascinating. But to really understand the engineering, we have to look at the fundamental strategy of human reproduction first, which relies on this concept called anisogamy.
Anisogamy.
Yeah, anisogamy. It's essentially the ultimate biological division of labor because reproduction here requires two gametes, but they are of vastly different sizes.
Right, the female cell, the ovum or the egg, is massive by comparison.
Huge, because it contains all the cellular machinery, the nutrients, the cytoplasm. Basically, everything needed to sustain a new life is packed in there.
And then you have the male cell.
Right. The much smaller male cell, which is entirely stripped down for mobility. Its job isn't to build the new organism. Its job is literally just to deliver half of the nuclear genetic blueprint, so 23 chromosomes in humans, across a really treacherous environment.
And building that delivery vehicle is a massive logistical undertaking all on its own. Like if you look at the process of spermatogenesis, which is the manufacturing phase in the testicle's seminiferous tubules,
Yeah, it's incredibly involved.
it looks like a painstakingly slow spacecraft assembly line. You start with this precursor cell that divides, has its chromosomes, but from that starting point to having a fully mature, mission-ready cell, the body takes roughly 3 months.
Which sounds like a long time for a single cell.
It does. It spends about 70 days just on the initial construction and then another 60 days just on maturation.
Well, the length of that assembly line makes sense when you consider the extreme structural modifications taking place. The cell literally sheds almost all of its cytoplasm.
The cytoplasm being that jelly-like substance that fills normal cells, right?
Right. It just throws it out to reduce weight and improve its aerodynamics for swimming. What you're left with is an anatomy optimized into three distinct sections. First, you have the head.
Which is packed with the DNA.
Exactly. But it's not a simple container. It houses DNA that is densely coiled into these tight chromatin fibers. And at the very tip of that head is a structure called the acrosome. It's a flattened sac that is just brimming with highly specialized digestive enzymes.
I pictured it like a microscopic payload of acid meant to burn through a vault door.
That is its exact function, which we'll see in the final stages of its journey. But behind the head is the midpiece. This acts as the powerhouse. It's packed with 10 to 14 spirals of mitochondria wrapped tightly around a central filament.
Wow, just coiled right in there.
Coiled up tight. And finally, you have the flagellum, the tail. It's about 50 micrometers long, and it has to generate enough force to propel this entire structure at speeds of 1 to 3 millimeters per minute.
Which doesn't sound fast to us.
No, but at a microscopic scale, trying to push through viscous fluids, that is a monumental physical feat.
I have to admit, reading through the sources, the complexity really threw me. Because if the female ovum handles all the heavy lifting of actually growing the embryo, and this cell is basically just a microscopic USB drive carrying 23 chromosomes.
Right, to just plug into the egg.
Yeah. Why does it have a parts list of at least 7,500 different proteins? And the DNA itself is compacted 6 times tighter than the DNA in any of our regular somatic cells.
Yeah.
It just feels completely over-engineered for a simple delivery run.
Well, that over-engineering is necessary because the delivery parameters are so strict. I mean, the tight compaction of the DNA being 6 times denser than normal, that is pure spatial efficiency. The cell has to be as small and light as physically possible to keep moving.
Okay, that makes sense.
But it brings more than just the genetic code. It actually carries a specific signaling factor designed to jolt the egg out of a metabolically dormant state upon entry.
Oh, wow. So it wakes the egg up.
It does. And crucially, it also delivers a structure called the centriole.
Yes. I noticed that in the text. It's like the egg has everything it needs to divide except the spark plug.
That's a great way to put it. The centriole is essentially the structural anchor. Once fertilization happens, the new zygote needs to start pulling itself apart to multiply. The male centriole acts as the organizing center for the microtubule system.
Which is the scaffolding for cell division.
Exactly. Without it, the fertilized egg would just sit there. It couldn't develop. And what's equally revealing is what the cell leaves behind.
Right.
All those spiraling mitochondria in the midpiece that power the tail, they degrade and are completely destroyed after fertilization.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This is why you inherit your mitochondrial DNA almost exclusively from your mother. The male provides the blueprints and the ignition switch, but none of the long-term metabolic machinery.
So the powerhouse does its job and then just gets discarded. So, okay, the machine is built, the payload is packed. Now we get to the deployment. And once it leaves the male body, it enters an environment that is biologically designed to be hostile.
Extremely hostile.
The female reproductive tract is highly acidic to protect against bacterial infections. And this tiny cell is fragile, it degrades in warm environments, and now it has to swim through literal acid.
Which is why the deployment requires synchronized chemical warfare. The fluid carrying the cells, the semen, is naturally alkaline. Its first biological objective is to neutralize those acidic vaginal fluids,
creating a temporary, localized safe zone.
Right. However, the sperm cells are not fully operational the second they arrive. It takes them 20 to 30 minutes to boot up their systems and reach a state of hypermotility where they can actually swim effectively.
So during that window, they're basically sitting ducks.
Complete sitting ducks.
So they drop a bunker. I love this part. Fibrinogen, which is a chemical from the seminal vesicles, actually forms a protective clot around the cells right after deployment.
It physically locks them in a biological shield.
Right, while they get their engines running. And then once that 20 to 30 minute boot up sequence is complete, a completely different chemical called fibrinolysin, which is released by the prostate gland, acts like a blowtorch.
Dissolving the clot.
Yeah. It dissolves the clot and releases them for the final sprint.
It's a perfectly timed multi-stage deployment, but, you know, that physical bunker only solves the acid problem. They still have to deal with the female immune system.
Because to the female body, these are invaders.
Exactly. From the perspective of the female immune system, these cells are foreign invaders carrying alien DNA. Standard biological logic dictates that white blood cells should immediately swarm and destroy them.
So how do they survive that?
To prevent an immunological slaughter, the sperm cells utilize that specific glycoprotein coating we mentioned earlier. It essentially acts as an invisibility cloak.
The same exact cloak that cancer and HIV hijack.
That's the one. The cell is broadcasting a molecular signal saying, I belong here, do not engage.
And it works.
It works flawlessly. But here's the profound irony of this whole system. The male body actually has to protect these cells from its own immune system while they are being manufactured.
Wait, his own immune system would attack them?
Yes. Because the cells undergo genetic shuffling during meiosis, their DNA no longer perfectly matches the rest of the man's body. His own white blood cells would recognize them as a threat and destroy them before they ever leave.
So the body builds a wall. The blood test is barrier.
Exactly.
It's a literal physical barricade of tightly joined Sertoli cells that keeps the male's blood supply and all the immune cells within it completely separated from the developing sperm.
Mm.
The cell is a total foreigner from the moment of its creation.
It is entirely isolated. And that isolation, combined with its stripped-down anatomy, creates a major vulnerability.
Yeah.
We really need to talk about the payload itself.
Right.
Because they jettison their cytoplasm to save weight, they also jettison most of the defensive mechanisms, like antioxidants, that normal cells use to protect their DNA.
So what does this all mean for someone living in the modern world? Because, I mean, we are surrounded by things that damage DNA.
We are.
The sources are very clear. The human spermatozoa are exceptionally vulnerable to free radicals and oxidative stress. We are talking about everyday environmental hazards, tobacco smoke, occupational exposure to benzene, widespread insecticides, and perfluorinated compounds.
Those are the forever chemicals, or PFAS.
Exactly.
Well, exposure to those chemicals significantly increases the rate of DNA fragmentation and a condition called aneuploidy.
Aneuploidy. What is that exactly?
Aneuploidy simply means the cell ends up with an incorrect number of chromosomes, so maybe 22 or 24 instead of the required 23. And if a cell with aneuploidy manages to fertilize an egg, it usually leads to severe fertility issues, miscarriages, or pretty deleterious developmental effects on the embryo.
I was wondering about quality control with all of this. Like, if the DNA is packed six times tighter than normal and they have no cytoplasm, are they just sitting ducks for oxidative damage? Or is it any internal repair mechanism?
You know, for decades, biologists assumed they were completely defenseless because the physical space is so constrained that the bulky molecular machinery required for DNA repair simply shouldn't fit.
Right.
But recent discoveries revealed that sperm possess a truncated, highly modified version of what's called the base excision repair pathway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it utilizes an enzyme called OGG1 to scan the tightly packed DNA for oxidized damage and essentially snip out and patch the errors.
It's like a microscopic repair crew working inside a packed filing cabinet.
Exactly. But this system degrades as men age. The body actually has a bouncer at the door called apoptosis.
A bouncer?
Yeah, it's a programmed cell death sequence that forces defective cells to self-destruct before they can be deployed. But as a man gets older, that apoptotic bouncer gets lazy.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, damaged cells slip through the quality control checks, leading to higher rates of DNA double-strand breaks in the deployed payload.
The margin for error is incredibly thin, which makes the behavior of the DNA itself quite interesting. Like, the text mentioned genetic recombination.
Right, the process where chromosomes swap pieces to create genetic diversity.
Exactly. It happens at different rates.
Mm-hmm.
Maternal DNA in the egg recombines about 42 times on average. But the paternal DNA inside the sperm only recombines about 27 times.
It's as if the paternal side prioritizes stability and delivery over genetic shuffling.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. The final breach.
Oh, yeah.
Once they survive the acid, evade the immune system, and outpace the defective cells, they have to physically locate the target. And they don't just swim randomly, do they?
No, they use chemotaxis. The cells have olfactory receptors. They literally sniff out a chemical gradient emitted by the egg and swim toward the source.
They sniff their way there.
They do. But the closer they get to the source, the more their environment changes. The egg is surrounded by a thick layer of cumulus cells and a highly viscous gel-like substance made of hyaluronic acid.
Like hitting a wall of molasses.
Exactly. And the standard rhythmic swimming motion they use to travel through the reproductive tract isn't powerful enough to get through this barrier. So they undergo a behavioral shift called hyperactivation.
It's the biological equivalent of hitting the nitrous boost in a racing game.
Perfect analogy.
They stop swimming in a straight line, and their tails start thrashing with pure, erratic, whip-like power to violently punch through the gel. But how does the cell trigger that burst of energy?
Well, it relies on specific ion channels located in the tail, known as Katzper channels. When the sperm detects it is near the egg, these channels pop open.
Just pop open?
Yeah, and this causes a sudden, massive influx of calcium ions to flood into the flagellum. That rapid change in cellular chemistry alters the motor proteins, causing those deep asymmetrical bends that generate the sheer physical force needed to bore through the hyaluronic acid.
And once they punch through that outer gel, they hit the final barrier, the zona pellucida, which is the protective shell of the egg itself. And this is where the acrosome, that sack of enzymes in the head we talked about, is finally triggered.
Right. The acrosome reaction is just a masterclass in biological security. The sac ruptures, releasing the digestive enzymes to dissolve a pathway through the shell. But it isn't just indiscriminate acid.
It's not.
No, it relies on an incredibly precise lock and key mechanism. The sperm has to bind to a very specific receptor protein on the egg called ZP3.
ZP3.
Yes. And this binding is species specific. It acts as an evolutionary failsafe, ensuring that human sperm can only trigger the reaction on a human egg.
Wow.
Once that lock turns, the membranes fuse, the 23 chromosomes are pulled inside, and the egg instantly alters its outer shell to prevent any other sperm from entering.
The fact that any of us exist at all is staggering when you consider the gauntlet that a single cell had to run.
It truly is.
But I want to pull back from the microscopic mechanisms for a second and look at how humans interact with this biology. Because this genetic payload is so valuable, we haven't just left it to nature. We've figured out how to extract, store, and commercialize it. which introduces a bizarre global market and some very strange legal frameworks.
The foundation of that market is our ability to artificially pause the biological clock. Scientists use an IVT diluent to keep the cells viable outside the body.
So it's not just stored in water.
Oh, no. It's a precisely engineered cocktail. It includes salts to maintain osmotic pressure so the cells don't burst, sugars to fuel those mitochondria in the midpiece, and antibacterial agents.
Because of the sugar.
Right. If you put a sugar-rich fluid in a warm environment, bacteria will colonize it instantly. They also pump it with CO2 to stabilize the pH. With that diluent, you can keep the cells alive at room temperature for over 7 days.
And if you drop the temperature entirely with cryopreservation, you freeze molecular motion completely. The text actually noted the current record for a successful human birth using frozen sperm is 21 years.
You are literally pausing a potential human life across decades.
Which leads right into the massive global sperm economy.
Mm.
Denmark, specifically, is a titan in this industry. They export human sperm to over 50 countries. Yet, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration heavily restricts or outright bans these imports.
The contrast there is fascinating. Denmark dominates because their market is highly structured and transparent. Donors are rigorously screened, they're often highly educated, and the clinics provide extensive profiles, baby photos, audio interviews, things like that.
Yeah.
Furthermore, Denmark gives donors the option to be non-anonymous, which is highly sought after by a lot of receiving couples.
So why does the FDA block a resource that 50 other nations completely trust?
Well, the FDA's restriction is officially based on the theoretical risk of transmitting Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, more commonly known as mad cow disease.
Mad cow disease. But based on the anatomical mechanisms we just went through, a prion transmission seems biologically absurd.
It borders on the impossible. Creutzfeldt-Jakob is caused by prions, which are misfolded proteins. For a prion to be transmitted via seminal fluid, it would have to circulate in the man's blood and then successfully navigate across the blood testis barrier.
The wall we talked about.
Right. That barrier is expressly designed to keep large immune proteins out of the seminiferous tubules. The statistical probability is vanishingly small, yet it forms the basis of a rigid international regulatory ban.
It really highlights how regulatory law often struggles to keep pace with biological reality. And, I mean, the legal philosophy gets even weirder when we talk about ownership. Like, what exactly is a frozen sperm cell in the eyes of the law?
That's a huge debate.
The source material references a 2009 UK Court of Appeal ruling, which heavily cited a landmark 1993 California case called Hecht v. Superior Court. The courts determined that ejaculated sperm, preserved for reproductive purposes, is legally considered the property of the man who produced it.
It forces the legal system to define cellular biology through the lens of asset management. The reasoning essentially rests on the idea that because the individual generated the cells, and because those cells hold unique future utility, specifically the creation of human life, the man retains a tangible property interest in them.
It transforms microscopic machines into a legally protected estate. We apply human legal constraints to it, but, you know, nature doesn't care about our laws or our textbook diagrams. If we look beyond humans, the extremes of the animal kingdom make our reproductive biology look incredibly tame.
Oh, absolutely. Human biology is quite conservative compared to what happens in, say, insects. Take Drosophila bifurca, which is a species of fruit fly.
Okay.
It produces the largest known spermatozoon in the entire natural world. The single cell measures over 58 millimeters long.
I crunched the numbers on that while I was reading the notes. 58 millimeters is over 2 inches long.
Right.
That is 20 times the entire length of the fly producing it. Like, if a human male produced a single gamete scale to 20 times his body length, he would be launching a single cell the size of a blue whale.
It's hard to even picture.
Why did the fruit fly need a 2-inch-long sperm cell?
It is the ultimate brute force strategy for sperm competition. Female fruit flies have a seminal receptacle where they store sperm from multiple mates. The massive length of this cell allows it to physically displace the sperm of rival males. It acts like a microscopic broom, sweeping competitors out of the storage organ to ensure its own genetic material is used. Producing a cell that massive requires immense metabolic energy, which also acts as a biological signal to the female that this specific male possesses superior, highly resilient genetics.
It's extreme physical warfare. But it's not always about competition, right? Sometimes you see incredible cooperation. The wood mouse is a perfect example of that.
Yes. The wood mouse possesses a really unique anatomical feature. It has an apical hook on the head of the sperm. So instead of swimming as isolated individuals, they use these hooks to latch onto the flagella of other sperm from the same male.
So they link up.
Exactly. They form literal mobile trains consisting of hundreds or even thousands of cells. By swimming together in an aggregate formation, they alter the fluid dynamics around them, achieving significantly faster motility through the female reproductive tract than a single cell ever could alone.
It's a cooperative transit system. And just to break all the rules entirely, there are organisms where the gametes don't even swim at all.
Right. Certain red algae and fungi produce completely non-motile cells called spermatia. They have no tails.
So how do they get anywhere?
Well, some rust fungi even secrete a sugary nectar to attract flies. And the flies inadvertently carry the spermatia to nearby organisms. It's an exact mimicry of how bees pollinate flowers, but applied to microscopic fungal reproduction.
It really drives home the point that evolution doesn't favor one specific diagram. It only favors whatever mechanism successfully bridges the gap between two halves of a genetic code, whether that requires a 58-millimeter broom, a cooperative train, or a hijacked insect.
That's exactly it.
So the next time you think about the origins of your own life, toss out that flat 2D circle with a squiggly line. Picture the 3-month assembly line. Remember the 7,500 proteins, the stealth bomber glycoprotein invisibility cloak, the physical barricades, and the calcium-triggered nitrous boost through hyaluronic acid.
It's a lot to wrap your head around.
It is an unparalleled sequence of chemical engineering that had to execute flawlessly for you to be here.
What's fascinating to me here is how our perception has evolved over time. I mean, in 1677, Antony van Leeuwenhoek was the first human to ever observe these cells through a primitive microscope.
1677.
Yeah, and he named them animalcules, or little animals. At the time, the prevailing scientific theory was preformationism, which is the belief that each cell contained a microscopic, fully formed human sitting right inside it.
Just a tiny little person.
Right. Today, obviously, we know that's not true. But when you examine the immense automated complexity packed inside that tiny space, you realize Leeuwenhoek's sense of absolute awe was entirely justified.
It's a microscopic machine carrying the blueprint of our species. Which leaves me with one final thought for you to ponder. We've established how vulnerable these cells are once they shed their cytoplasm. We've talked about how their DNA repair pathways degrade over time and how susceptible they are to modern industrial realities. You know, forever chemicals, benzene, and insecticides.
Yeah, they're everywhere.
Given how heavily industrialized our daily environment has become, how might those invisible chemicals be quietly rewriting the genetic future of human evolution, one microscopic cell at a time? It definitely makes you look at that simple high school diagram in a much more profound light.